This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by a leading surgeon, brilliant guy, Dr. Scott Sigmund. Scott, do you want to take a moment to introduce yourself? Then we're going to discuss, say, opioids, opioid sparing strategies, and more in practice today. Can you take a moment and introduce yourself?
Absolutely, Scott. Thank you so much. So I like to describe myself as the original opioid sparing orthopedic surgeon, healer of knees and shoulders left and right, social media influencer, hashtag follow the fro. So I appreciate very much the opportunity to be here to really talk about what is really very important to me and something that I routinely talk about, which is our success stories with opioid sparing orthopedic surgery.
And take a moment to describe follow the fro.
So if people do know me, they actually can recognize me quite clearly for my signature hair. And it's interesting, over the last 7 years, I've gone from podium to podium, city to city, and actually even across the world now, describing our things. And it's become a little bit of a shtick. And every time I go to a meeting now, it's really quite fascinating. I'll walk around and somebody will tap me on the shoulder and say, "Just want you to know that I'm following the fro, and thanks for all you're doing." So it's kind of a fun thing. It would sort of grow on its own.
That's fantastic. And talk about the situation with opioids. How much the opioid crisis was created from people just doing opioids as a drug that became an addiction, and how much that addiction was spurred by somebody getting turned onto it originally through a medical procedure? Because, you know, you would think with the literature, you know, sometimes you might think that 98% of opioid addiction came from somebody having a surgery and then turned into an opioid user. What is the situation?
Yeah, it's really very unfortunate. I think that, unfortunately, elective surgery became an inadvertent gateway to the epidemic. And there was sort of this whole societal pressure around the management of pain in the 90s. You know, I graduated medical school in the 90s, did my residency in Boston, then did my fellowship at Curl and Job. And in that time and age, basically, we were taught that, you know, look, orthopedic surgery hurts, right? You know, you're taking saws and drills and bones are breaking. And so you have an obligation to make sure that your patients are out of pain. And you're going to use these opioids because they're really inexpensive and they're really not very addictive. And those two things couldn't be anything further than the truth. And, you know, there's some bad apples out there. There are some doctors that are in charge of pill mills and things like that. They're getting arrested. But the bottom line is that the most of us were just following the path, the society of pain that was set up with pain becoming a vital sign, and then being educated, the doctors and nurses in medical school and nursing school, and then we're basically, you need to make sure your patients are out of pain, and it really sort of took on a life of its own, and we were all just sort of caught up in it. And at the end of the day, most of us, I think, really just got schnookered. And, you know, 7 years ago when I started this campaign of really trying to avoid opioids, I was just very dissatisfied with what we were doing. And the opioid epidemic was in full steam. And I practiced in Lowell, Massachusetts, just north of Boston. And the epidemic was hitting us really hard. And I was just like, we got to figure something out. We got to do this better. You know, what can we do to avoid these opioids? And that's sort of where the techniques really were drawn from initially.
And talk to us about, how do you move away from using opioids? How did that work, and how much pain does the patient have? And just talk to us a little bit about this.
Yeah, so, you know, it's evolved over time. It really started in the inpatient world, and there was a medication called liposomal bupivacaine that came out. When, it's funny, you know, Exparel, if you look at the literature, there's probably over 1,000 studies that have been done, 500 positive, 500 negative. I joke around, I say that Exparel is sort of like the Grateful Dead and black licorice. You either love it or you hate it. You know, there's no in between. But at the end of the day, it was a technique with a long-acting anesthetic that could be injected into the surgical site that profoundly sort of limited pain in what I describe as the storm of pain. The storm of pain is in that first 72 hours. So if you can get somebody gently through that initial wave of the post-operative pain, most of the time they don't require narcotics. So that liposomal bupivacaine sort of became the foundation for what we were doing. And then we transitioned that into the outpatient world. And nowadays it's really fascinating. I mean, we're doing opioid-free ACL surgery. And these athletes, you know, these Division I athletes that had college scholarships. They get their ACL done, and then 6 months later, they're dead of a bad heroin overdose. And these patients in particular were so incredibly vulnerable to the effects of opioids. So, you know, we're now doing opioid-free ACL surgery, not because the patients are sitting there lying in pain, but because we're using other modalities to manage their pain without the addictive opioids. Rotator cuff surgery, for example, which was always considered one of the most painful surgeries. Don't get it done. You know, you got that big black pillow, you're going to sleep in a recliner, you're going to be on opioids for 6 weeks. My patients are undergoing rotator cuff surgery, opioid-free, not because they're in pain, because they just don't need the medication. I'm going to give you three numbers, which I quote routinely when I'm on the podium. 6, 13, and 30. If you're kind enough to write a 24-hour prescription of opioids to your patient, even after, you know, a minor surgery, the CDC study clearly shows that 6 out of 100 patients will still be on opioids at 1 year. All you did was write them a script for 24 hours, and 6 out of 100 are still on opioids. If you give them a 10-day supply, 13 out of 100 are still on opioids at 1 year. And if you're really kind, because they come from a distance and you really want to make sure they're addicted, give them 30 pills or give them 30-day supply, and a third of them will still be on opioids at 1 year. So to be perfectly honest, you have to maintain opioid naivete on your patients in order to make sure they can safely and effectively get through their surgery without addiction.
Wow. So if somebody is on them for 24 hours, you've got a 6% chance of being on them for another year. If they're on it if you give them a 10-day supply, that number doubles, or more than doubles. And if you give them a 30-day supply and they sort of work that 30-day supply, there's a 33% chance they're going to be addicted a year from now.
You got it. And that is just scary, right? I mean, you think about that. You know, they're addictive, they're not addictive, we don't really know, but those are the hard numbers. It's really that. So when I have a patient says, oh, I don't really have a problem with opioids, I'm like, yeah, but, you know, this is my responsibility. We want to do this. Most of the patients nowadays, to be honest with you, Scott, are thrilled to know that there's opioid alternative surgery available, because everybody knows somebody. Usually when I give one of my talks, I ask everybody to stand up. And then I say, if you know somebody that's been affected by the opioid crisis, please remain standing. And it's usually everybody. There's a cousin, a relative, a colleague, somebody that's been affected. So they love the option of having opioid alternative surgery.
100%. And so what is, in terms of managing that pain, like you talk about this, you know, 24 to 72-hour period, that's the most challenging period where the patient really feels like they need stronger narcotics. What are the alternatives? How do you deal with the pain in that first period of time to sort of get them to that spot where they really can move towards Tylenol, move towards less significant pain relief medicine?
Yeah, great question. I'm going to give you the exact method in which we do it. So if it's an upper extremity surgery, they wind up getting a regional block. It's called a scalene block. It's done under ultrasound with an anesthesiologist. It's FDA approved. We use liposomal bupivacaine for that. And basically, it numbs up the arm typically for about 24 hours. They get motor weakness for up to about 36 hours, but they can get pain relief for upwards of 3 to 5 days. So that block really sets them up for success early on. And then what we do is we write 3 specific prescriptions, and we encourage the patients to use those prescriptions. The number one prescription that I write is Tylenol, 1,000 milligrams, every 8 hours for 5 days. And I don't tell them over the counter, just take it as you need it. I literally write a prescription. This is an integral part of your post-op pain management, and I'm going to give you a script for that. We then use meloxicam. Meloxicam is a once-a-day anti-inflammatory that does not require prior authorization, so everybody can get it. And then we also use gabapentin. We do it 300 milligrams only at nighttime because it can cause dizziness. But it's another method of creating pain relief through a different pathway to the brain that also helps the patient sleep. So for 5 days, we use those 3 medications prescription. We then will provide them 5 pills of short-acting narcotic, Oxy-IR typically, and we encourage them not to take the medication. There's been multiple studies that show if you even just have the conversation with the patient that you don't need to take the opioids, you'll see a significant reduction in the use of the opioids.
Got it. So if somebody, the fascinating thing, the 1,000 milligram Tylenol, is that you actually write a prescription for it, even though it's not a prescription drug, if I'm correct. And some people don't think it's an option. And this avoids them getting to that spot where they feel in such pain because they didn't take it, they thought it was an option, and then feel like they need to take the opioid.
Absolutely. And that encouragement and letting them know that these other medications that work differently than the opioids, they work well. They can provide significant pain relief. And it's really sort of an all hands on deck. So let's move to another procedure. So let's talk about total knee replacement, which I do a lot of. There's a newer medical device that's called Iovera, I-O-V-E-R-A. It's a fascinating device. It's liquid nitrous oxide that we use to basically create an axonemesis. We freeze the nerves. We don't ablate them. We're temporarily freezing the nerves of the femoral cutaneous nerve, which is the skin nerve above the knee, and then the infrapatellar branch of the saphenous nerve, which is the inside of the knee. And it's just cutaneous nerves that we're freezing. And they freeze for about 90 days. And what that does is provide significant pain relief into the rehab period. We then use liposomal bupivacaine at the time of the surgery. We do an injection into the surgical field for that 72-hour window. We then give the same medications that we're talking. And in my clinical hands now, we're seeing 80% of our patients walk in 2 weeks after a knee replacement, holding a cane with no assisted devices and basically off all medication within 5 days after the surgery, which is profound compared to what we were doing only 5 years ago with how we were managing our patients for total knee replacement.
And how cooperative are the other physicians, the other providers, if people go into the rehab place after the knee replacement surgery, particularly an elderly patient, how cooperative is everybody else in the strategy? Do you get pushback at all? Or is everybody pretty much on board today?
It's, you know, the only way it works is to have a team approach. So I know you know Zeev Kane very well, perioperative college. He talks about the team approach. It's one of his most important tenets. And that, it couldn't be more true. If you have your PACU nurse telling that the shoulder patient you just operated on that when the block wears off, you need to take narcotics because you're going to have severe pain, then you just blew up everything you tried to accomplish. So having the rehab people, having the physical therapist, having the nurses, having the anesthesiologist, all of the nursing and the entire perioperative team on the same approach minimizes the risk of these patients, you know, having problems. And so if you do that and you have that approach, you're going to have success.
And if you don't, largely debacle.
Yeah, exactly. And that, and then, you know, they wind up giving them the opioids anyway. And we just talked about it. Even if you screw up and you give them opioids for 24 hours, there's a chance that they're going to get addicted to the medication.
Right. And people think that they're doing the patient a favor because they have a happier patient the next few days. But in the long term, they're really doing a huge disservice.
I'll tell you, you know, the most liberating thing that I did in clinical practice is, and this is what I try to tell everybody, you know, sort of my closing arguments when I'm trying to convince other doctors across the country to adopt this philosophy, is the most liberating thing that I've done in clinical practice is become an opioid-sparing surgeon. I mean, not only was I an orthopedic surgeon, but I was a pain management specialist. What does that mean? It means I was writing secondary prescriptions. I was weaning patients off medications. I didn't really quite realize the addictive potential of the medication, but that's what we were taught. I followed along and that's what I was doing. But now we don't write refills. There's no reason to have refills. We don't have patients that are addicted to opioids calling us in the middle of the night asking for additional medication. So there's a lot of satisfaction as the clinician, much less the healthy effects that you're going to get beneficial for your patients as well.
Right. And thank goodness you don't have people calling to ask for refills and so forth. That's the last thing you want today.
Yeah, absolutely. Because then if they're asking on refills, we just talked about it. By definition, they're showing signs of addiction to the medication. And then you have to do the weaning process to get them off.
What is still incredibly challenging today about this practice and this evolution? What still is going on today where you see great challenges?
So that's a great question. And unfortunately, opioid alternatives are more expensive than opioids. Opioids are actually relatively inexpensive to manufacture and utilize. So the alternatives are more expensive. And so what we've run into in many respects is a cost analysis. And the pharmacies within the hospitals, make, for example, will do a cost analysis and say, well, we can't afford $300 a patient to use this opioid alternative, so you're going to have to come up with other ways to use it. And unfortunately, there are not a lot of other ways right now currently in the perioperative setting to be able to provide the long-term pain relief. So, you know, IV Tylenol, for example, is a lot more expensive than oral Tylenol, but yet it provides a significant reduction in pain in the immediate perioperative setting. There's really good news on the horizon, though. As of January 1st, CMS, out of a lot of lobbying that occurred, both myself and a lot of other passionate doctors have recognized at this point that it is worthwhile to use these opioid alternatives, and now they're pulling them out of the DRG budget for the individual procedure, and they will pay for them individually. So there'll be J codes, so that if you're in a surgery center and you have a Medicare patient, as of January 1st, you can bill for liposomal bupivacaine or the IV Tylenol and get paid for it separately. So the financial concern of using these opioid alternatives goes away. I mean, if you look to the cost of our society of this opioid epidemic throughout the healthcare industry, to our firefighters and EMTs, to the lack of work and the work and the people that aren't showing up for work because of opioids. I mean, it's just a crazy financial loss, much less the loss of life associated. So we have to spend money on the front side of the epidemic to prevent the next wave of patients that would be addicted to opioids.
Right. No, and you certainly see, as you travel through different areas of the country, the acuteness of the problem is insane in certain areas. It's a challenge every place, but it's literally insane. In certain communities, you can't get into a vehicle without somebody talking about their first cousin or their relative or their brother or sister having an opioid problem. It's just incredibly pervasive, and it seems to be moving a little bit in the right direction.
I can tell you, when I first started giving these talks, I was lucky to have maybe four or five people in a room. But now, regardless of what city I go to, and I travel typically about 2 to 3 times a month to be able to educate, you know, doctors and nurses and perioperative teams about our success stories, the rooms are filled. So, you know, we're really getting a sense that the tide is turning. The paradigm of perioperative pain management is really shifting away from opioids to these other alternatives, which we can use quite successfully.
Thank you. And I know, Dr. Sigmund, you're both a magnificent surgeon and a magnificent speaker. If people want to learn more about your practice, if they want to talk to you about a procedure, or if they want advice of this, as other surgeons or other healthcare providers want advice, either whatever it is, how do people reach you and learn more about your practice?
Sure. So I have my website at scottasigmundmd.com. I'm also on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram, all under the same moniker of Scott A. Sigmund, MD. More than happy to answer questions and arrange for talks, and any opportunity that I have to be able to talk, I'm hoping that people will listen and we take advantage of it for sure.
Well, what you're doing and what you're encouraging has made a world of difference to the long-term health of so many people. So we appreciate you greatly joining us today, and continued success in what you're doing. What a great job you're doing trailblazing in this. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity, Scott. Looking forward to seeing you at a couple of your conferences coming up, too.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Dr. Sigmund.
All right, take care.